Maybe your garden overflows with tomatoes. Escoffier has some ideas for those. This is the conclusion of the vegetable portions of Chapter 13, Vegetables and Farinaceous Products, in the Escoffier series. The chapter isn't over, but this part is. There's rice, yeah, a veg, but I don't know how, and tomatoes and truffles to cover. Yeah, you heard that right. Truffles. The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 294, Food and Freedom, Once a Week for Life. Hello, folks. Dan Reed here. Welcome back to the program. I've been a head chef, a head baker, a culinary arts instructor, and a line cook. I've worked with certified master chefs as well as superbly talented chefs, and along the way, I've cooked a lot of vegetables. I've taught vegetable cookery in a culinary school, and now I'm sharing that content in the confines of classical French cooking with you. Chapter 13 has certainly given us plenty to look at. We're winding up the veg portion today, and then the farinaceous products remains. Now, Escoffier includes rice in the vegetable portion, not the starch portion, which seems at least curious. Basic white rice is, or should be, pretty easy to cook. Converted white rice is about 2-to-1 water to rice. Rice cookery can get confusing quickly, though. 2 cups of rice is cooked in about 3.5 cups of water, not 4 cups. 3 cups of rice is cooked in about 5 cups of water, not 6. There, at some point, it would be a 1-to-1, but that would be more than we're worried about, and I don't want to. It's already too much. Brown rice, black rice, wild rice are all slightly different, and in some cases not rice at all, but that's another story. Aromatic rices, mostly basmati and jasmine, are different again. Since this isn't a rice episode, those will have to wait. Now, Escoffier mentions, well, technically 3, but mostly 2 kinds of rice, Patna and Carolina. Now, Patna is a long grain white rice, longer than what we know of as rice. Most Americans probably are familiar with Uncle Ben's or Mahatma brand white rice, and there are other ones. That rice is, you know, sort of a long oval. It cooks nicely into distinct grains and is what we would call fluffy rice. Patna is an aromatic rice, which means it has a delicate perfume aroma. Now, it's not strong, but it's sometimes you sort of have to use your imagination, but the perfumey aroma is there. Basmati and jasmine, as previously mentioned, are probably the most popular aromatic rices in the U.S. Escoffier suggests Patna rice as being well suited for rice pilaw, or what we would call rice pilaf. Now, Carolina can be substituted if the needs be. Carolina rice is preferred by Escoffier for sweet dishes, think desserts, and salads, but does also use Patna for some salads. Now, he identifies the Piedmont variety of rice as suitable for risotto, and that's risotto grains are generally going to be shorter than even converted white rice. They're going to be much fatter, have a higher starch content, and that starch content is really the quality that gives risotto its smooth, starchy, sort of sauce-like consistency. Now, Escoffier makes a point to indicate that for certain dishes, the Carolina and the Patna rice is to remain unrinsed. Most of us who make rice don't rinse it, so it seems like an odd instruction. The aromatic rices are generally rinsed several times to ensure the excess starch is removed. When I make jasmine or basmati, I soak it, drain it, soak it again, drain it, then add water for the cooking. When I make regular white rice, the rice just gets added to the buttered, salted, boiling water. Now, the first issue is finding Patna or Carolina rice. They still exist and can be found online and in higher-end grocery stores. Most of us will buy Uncle Ben's or Mahatma or some other brand of converted white rice because it's there, it's easy, we're familiar with it, and the price point's good. For risotto, the most popular rice is Arborio, and in my opinion, is hardly worth buying when there is better risotto rice to be found. I did an entire episode on risotto, culinarylibertarian.com/126. I discussed the various grains and the cooking processes. That's all I've got to say about that. Yeah, that was bad, I know. Rice pilaf sounds complicated, since there's nothing in the name to explain what's happening. Instead of making rice on the stovetop, pilaf has some aromatics in the initial cooking step, and it is baked instead of cooked on the stove. It's a pretty simple dish, and here's how to do it. And I want to clarify a point. I've used the word aromatic to describe a kind of rice, and then aromatics as an ingredient. Oh, what in the heck am I talking about? As an ingredient, not in the rice, aromatics are going to be mostly mirepoix, carrots, celery, onions. You can include in that fennel, leeks, parsnips, but it's going to be the Spanish and the Italian call it a sofrito. The French would never do that, but it's the vegetable base of flavor that's cooked first for some color to get the caramel. We've talked about caramelization a lot and how that equals flavor. And then also the veggies themselves contribute flavor to the finished dish. So aromatics will be vegetables. They can include herbs or spices. It's a big catch-all term, but I wanted to clarify because it possibly could be confusing talking about cooking a kind of rice using another kind of rice, and that's not at all what I was trying to convey. So, rice pilaf, procedure 40-39 is simple. Cook 50 grams, 2 ounces of small diced onion in 50 grams of butter until lightly golden brown in color. Add 250 grams, 9 ounces of unwashed Patna rice, mixing until the starch begins to make a milky appearance. Add, Escoffier uses the phrase moisten, add 2 5/8 cup of white bouillon stock, water will work, cover with a lid and cook in a moderate oven for 18 minutes. As soon as it is cooked, turn into another pan and carefully fork in 50 grams, 2 ounces of whole butter cut into small pieces. Now, the visual here might be a bit strange. You've cooked rice in a pan, you're dumping it out into another pan and then using a fork. And he's not clear about what he means by that. It's entirely possible that your dinner fork will work. What I would use, and what I think he means, is either what cooks call a tuning fork, which looks like a carving fork. It's usually black is the color of most professional handles on knives and forks. And it's just two prongs, can be from 6 until 12 inches, nothing really long, but they're straight, looks like a tuning fork. A roasting fork, same black handle, but a long, thick iron bar leading to two prongs about 3 inches in length, and they're going to have a curve to them. That curve and that really rigid iron bar is going to be, you're going to use that to lift a prime rib out of the roasting pan. So the tuning fork is Well, I hate tongs. I've talked about it before. So a tuning fork, because it's long and straight, will be good for turning things in a pan. It's also useful for spinning spaghetti or angel hair, linguine or fettuccine into a long sort of beehive thing that you can lay into the bowl before you add the sauce. They have some functions, but also the function is to aerate, fluff up cooked rice, and the butter is going in for flavor, of course, and the added butter coating all of those hot cooked rice grains is going to help them not stick. So fork in 50 grams, 2 ounces of whole butter cut into small pieces. The small pieces part just expedites the whole melting process. There is the risk that the more you monkey around with rice, with forks or anything else, you run the risk of breaking the rice grains, which we want to avoid. So that's the process. The one thing that's missing is salt. I don't know how he missed it, but definitely you want to add salt in your water. In the case of the pilaf, add the salt before you add the water and the rice. It doesn't really matter. Just as long as the salt is in there is the key part. Now, pilaf, nowadays, modern days, will often have the full mirepoix veggies instead of only onions. And you can really kind of go crazy with this basic procedure. So you're cooking the veg first, adding the rice, then the liquid, then covering and cooking. This whole basic process is wildly useful. Add some curry to the onions. Add chopped garlic or chopped chicken livers and gizzards. If you are from New Orleans, you say, oh, I know that dish. That's dirty rice. You can add pretty much anything at the first stage to make the rice dish specific to your meal needs. And it really is a great way to get a deeply flavored rice. Now, rice cooked this way does take a few more steps and at least one more pan than cooking on the stovetop. And the variety of flavors is well worth adding this to your standard procedures. When you fork in the butter, be careful how you say that, add chopped salad herbs, chives, parsley, cilantro, depending on how fine you cut it. Thyme would be okay. I would probably avoid raw, fresh rosemary and sage. No matter how small you cut them, just there's a potency there that might be more than you bargained for. Now, procedure 4242 shows just that idea of adding stuff. Now, the French word for rice is riz, R-A-Z, and I'm going to butcher this, but we already know that my French-speaking abilities are, well, they aren't great. So riz à la Turque, T-U-R-Q-U-E, riz, as so. Prepare the rice as for riz pilaf, adding approximately 2 grams of saffron to the bouillon. When the rice is cooked, mix in 150 grams of tomato fondue. That sounds fantastic. Tomato fondue is in the sauces section of the book. It is tomatoes and garlic cooked down first in really high heat of extra virgin olive oil and cooked until everything disintegrates. And it is just magnificent, especially when the tomatoes are brilliantly ripe. Oh my goodness. It's just great. So that sounds like this is an awesome, that would be a great rice dish. Escoffier offers some rice procedures that are just so odd to us, I have to mention at least one. The process is to cook, then drain the rice, and rinse it. Seems odd, yes? Procedure 4238, riz à l'Indienne, reads as so. Quote, cook 250 grams, 9 ounces, patna rice in 2.5 liters, 2¾ quarts, boiling water with 25 grams of salt. He didn't miss it that time. Allow to cook for 16 minutes from the time the water comes back to a boil, then drain, wash well in plenty of warm water, and drain again. Spread on a warm cloth on a tray and dry for 15 minutes in the warm oven. End quote. You may notice he didn't offer a final use. Salads. Cold salads, or most specifically, is the intended use for rice cooked this way. Notice the absence of butter or any fat in the cooking process. The key takeaway about rice in the pilaf method allows for much more flavor innovation than the stovetop method. You get a better product, too. Now, for those of you thinking you can cut this step out and do the pilaf method on the stovetop, the one risk involved is scorch. The direct contact, the conduction of pan to burner is pretty hot. And if your rice pretty hot, not this is going to be kind of low on the threshold, but the risk of scorch is high. The advantage of the oven is it's a fairly low temperature, 350 degrees, but it's completely surrounded, so all of that heat is uniform and even all the way around. The risk of scorch is virtually zero. So the uniformity of slowly cooking that rice with even heat gets a better product than could be achieved with all of that extra stuff in the rice on the stovetop. That's the reason to do it. And one tip, if you're going to add saffron to your rice, saffron is potent. It's very powerful in aroma and flavor and color, so a little goes a long way. Place a few strands in the palm of your hand and smash them with your fingertips. Now, sometimes saffron can be a bit M-word. Now, trigger warning, I'm going to say it, moist for you who don't follow that, so you may need to put them on a cutting board and cut them or chop them. Drizzle a few drops of olive oil on the strands of saffron, make sure they're all coated, and then cut them. The oil of the liquid part of the oil adds a surface tension, which will help prevent the strands from flying away, because if you've ever cut spaghetti, what happens is they just spring everywhere. Saffron can do the same thing, and all I see is dollar signs going when that happens. So the oil helps kind of hold that all together so the saffron is not bouncing all over the kitchen. The chief reason for oil and not water is the color in saffron is water soluble, not oil soluble. So if you're doing water on your cutting board, your color is going to go in your cutting board. You're going to not get all of it in your food, which of course is exactly where we want it. So add the saffron to the veggie part of your pilaf. The heat will release the aroma and open up the flavors. So when the water is added, you get the most out of the least amount of your saffron. Now, salsify is listed as the next veg, and I like it. It's hard to find, at least it seems hard to find, and it's not cheap when you can find it. The key things about salsify are these. There are two varieties, black and white. Sometimes it is called viper root or scorzonera. It's sticky when you peel it. It's almost like there's sap in it, and it makes your hands a bit sticky and then a little discolored. Also, salsify darkens quickly like apples or artichokes. It should be blanched in lightly acidulated water, which will stop the browning enzyme. And the par cooking does it some favors too, because it can sometimes be a long time to cook as you saute it. We used to cook salsify at the Governor's Club in Tallahassee as part of the veg for some of the dishes. I honestly can't remember everything that went into that, but I do know that we would cut it into little rounds, about 3/8 of an inch or so, just so it's got, you know, something you can eat, not skinny shaved. That would be silly. Scoffier offers some baked dishes for salsify and cream sauce. Salsify is mild in flavor. In some places, like my house, it grows in the lawn like a weed. It's everywhere. The wild variety roots are very fibrous and look more like an underdeveloped parsnip. There's not much to the root to compare to the commercial kind. you might see them and going to see, and you might think of them as some kind of giant dandelion, because that's what they look like. When they go to seed, they don't really have dandelion-looking leaves. There's this, mostly it's really tall stick with this fairly pretty flower that goes to that puffy seed pretty quickly, but it's three times the size of a dandelion puff. That's salsify, and the root will, so the black stuff, the oyster root, the scorzonera, that will be anywhere from 12 to 16 inches long, generally just as straight as can be. Hardly even any bumps or anything. Just like, wow, this is a dream to peel, mostly. It's the sticky, sappy part, but it's really nice. When you pick the wild stuff, it's got fibrous roots all over it, and it bends this way and that, and it's just like, well, this is not the same. So it's the roots I've pulled up, and I have transplanted them trying to make a salsify garden, and it just didn't work. So I see it every year. I think, oh, I'm going to get salsify, and no, I don't. Tomatoes, as a veg, I know they're not a veg, are mostly going to be stuffed with something, at least as far as the Escoffier's recipes are concerned. In nearly all cases, the tomato is cut in half, seeds and juice removed, the tomato is salted, stuffed, and baked. Now, in at least one case, he doesn't bake it. It is served cold with the stuff inside. There are a few alterations to the process. Sometimes the seeded halves are baked, then stuffed, and baked again to make the filling hot and then gratinated for pretty. Escoffier does not write to skin them first. Now, I've not been shy about stating I hate tomato skins when they are cooked. In this application, the skins are not made better. They do serve at least to help hold the tomato together a bit as it is cooked. Now, it will, when that tomato is cooked, the skin will easily slide off. But as a vehicle, as a container of sorts, while it's cooking, it does sort of help hold the tomato guts part together a little bit. Now, he's not always clear about what to do with the inside part of the tomato, which is one of the other issues. There's seeds and juice. Sure, that's fine. Then there's that meat inside, that pulpy stuff that sort of had the pockets for the seeds and juice. Leave it or carefully remove it. In some cases, he writes to remove the seeds and juice. And in another recipe, he writes to remove the insides without damaging the tomato. Now, it seems from my reading, the procedure asking for the insides to be removed is to take the flesh out as well. Nearly none of his recipes ask for the inside flesh to be used in the stuffing. This is not a suggestion that it is to be discarded. Even the tomato seeds can make a tomato seed vinaigrette, but at some point, how much tomato seed vinaigrette can you stand? It is, the flesh, a very fine thing to have to dice and add to almost anything you add tomatoes to, or salt them and eat them just as they are. Those tomatoes, the ones that are cut in half and at least seeded and juiced, that are baked, can present a problem. Now, you can probably visualize a round tomato half stuffed with mushroom duxelles and diced ham would not necessarily sit nicely on a flat baking dish since it is a round object. Rolling and tipping is very possible. To get around this issue, place some kosher salt in the bottom of the baking dish and rest the tomato on that. Now, very little salt, if any, will transfer to the tomato since the skin will be a barrier, and the salt will help hold the tomato in place so that it doesn't tip over and we get nice, good browning and baking and everything's uniform. The stuffed tomato idea was a popular-ish item in the 70s with tuna salad or something else inside a seeded whole tomato. Some main course lunch salad or cottage cheese inside of a tomato is a good lunch idea. For Escoffier's use, he's mostly offering that as an accompaniment to a main course. Now, you and I have probably seen some really big beefsteak tomatoes and we're thinking, wow, this is one heck of a side. So I think probably he's meaning something more on the smaller side than those gigantic tomatoes. As a main course, it would be fantastic. If you seeded, juiced, took the pulp out, possibly, maybe leave it in, I haven't decided yet, and put taco meat, really well seasoned, more than usual, taco meat on that tomato, and then cheddar cheese, and it probably doesn't need breadcrumbs because the cheese will melt and you can gratinate that. Then some sour cream, some avocado, some fresh cilantro on top if you're one of the 75% that doesn't taste soap, and whatever other of your favorite taco toppings are. That might be good. That sounds kind of fun. Interesting. All right, so he does offer one particular procedure, which is distinctly different. He writes, quote, select some firm, medium-sized tomatoes and cut them into 1 centimeter thick slices. Season with salt and pepper, then dip into light frying batter and deep fry in very hot fat as required. Drain, arrange on a serviette on a dish, and serve immediately, end quote. Now, very hot fat is unclear. Now, he says deep fry. I would pan fry in sufficient fat to cover them. And there's some weird words. Very hot fat is required. Well, what does required mean? What does sufficient fat mean? It means that depending on how big your pan is, I have an 8-inch cast iron and a 12-inch cast iron. One will require almost twice as much oil as the other one to fry the exact same thing. So enough oil that the thing being fried is at least covered halfway. So as required and sufficient, kind of the same thing. Now, tomato slices in a deep fryer sounds to me like a gigantic mess that I don't even want to bother cleaning. So we're going to do pan to contain the mess. Very hot, might be 375. I would be cautious about going that high. With a red tomato, it's possible since it is edible cold, all that really needs to happen is that the batter needs to cook, stick to the tomato on both sides, and then you serve it. I 400 would be too high. 375 is probably pushing it. And if you add 3 or 4 tomatoes, that heat's going to come way down anyway. But that whole idea of frying tomato slices might sound familiar to you. In the South, they took green tomatoes, made a 3-step breading process, and you know the rest. Now, Escoffier's last vegetable entry is truffles. There may be a few conclusions we can reach here. One, the king had nearly unlimited resources to buy truffles, or, maybe more likely, enough people who were hunting truffles for the king. Truffles may have been far more available now than now, probably, I'm guessing, I don't know, since cities were fewer and smaller. So there was more countryside, and therefore more truffles to find, probably. What is pretty clear today is not too many people can afford to have truffles as a vegetable. He offers 5 truffle procedures, and the 3 of them, the truffles, are whole. One, which uses thick slices, one of the other 2, is as much a pipe dream as the rest, but it sounds amazing. Slice 18 ounces of peeled raw truffles into thick slices. I don't know what thick is. And cook gently in 2 ounces of butter and then flamed brandy. At the same time, reduce 1¼ cups of sauce bechamel until very thick. Add the cooking liquor from the truffles, a good amount of heavy cream, and 2 ounces of butter. Mix in the truffles and serve in a vol-au-vent case. The level of decadence there is just spectacular. The only thing missing is a slab of foie gras. So I think thick slices should be not more than 3/8 of an inch just to make sure it all gets cooked. A good amount of cream. I think what really needs to happen here, since cook the bechamel until it's very thick, and then we're adding the liquor. That's going to dilute the bechamel a little bit, but that's what we want. We want what we want to end up with. So let's assume that our bechamel was perfect when it was made, and we went to the cooler and we took out 1¼ cups, cup and a quarter of sauce bechamel, reduced it a little bit. Let's say reduced it down to 3/4 cups. That's pretty reduced. So we're going to add this truffle liquor, which is 2 ounces of butter. We got a little bit of water in there. So let's say we got 20% loss on butter. So we have 1½ ounces-ish. The flamed brandy will be next to nothing. We'll pull some water out of the mushrooms. So let's say we end up with 2 ounces of liquid, but we've reduced by more than that. So the cream added is enough to bring it back to the original 1¼ cups. Add the truffle, serve it in a vol-au-vent case. Holy moly, that just, it's a $200 dish, but man, it sounds good. In case you didn't know, vol-au-vent cases are little cups made from puff pastry. If they're baked well, and that means really good and crisp, oh my goodness, it's just fantastic. Now, I said it sounded amazing, and it does, and I did say it would be expensive, and it would be, but wow, what a thing to think about. Mostly, and this is so for as long as I've been cooking, truffles were a luxury item used as a garnish in pâtés or a special ingredient in pasta or risotto dishes, and the finishing ingredient in sauces, sauce Perigordine or sauce Perigo. The significant difference is one, the truffle is carved like an olive, the other is chopped truffles. And I'm going to get in trouble because I can't remember which is which. In some cases, Tudor dos Rossini, the truffle is sliced as a garnish on top of the seared foie gras. Now, there's more to know about truffles that can be then can be covered in what remains of the thyme. The easiest distinction in truffles is between the black and the white. It gets more complicated after that. White truffles are a fall product and often sell for thousands of dollars per kilo. And I think the most famous white truffles come from northern Italy. It is a rare treat to find them or to work with them, and their flavor is deeply potent and complex. Black truffles have some distinctions which are no longer specific to France. China got into the truffle business some years ago. In doing a quick bit of hunting, I think Australia's somehow in the truffle business. I'm not sure I read that right, but there are more choices than just France, and Italy does, I think, have some black truffles. The Chinese truffles are cheaper, they're smaller, they're not quite as potent as the French truffles, and they're cheaper. They are a very suitable substitute. Now, when I say French truffles, that conceals that there are at least two kinds of French truffles, the summer and the winter, which is more popularly known by the word Perigo, P-E-R-I-G-O-D, so we get sauce Perigordine. The Perigo truffles are, they do look pretty similar, and well, big deal, what does that mean? They're round-ish, They have they can have little bumps and contours on them. If you know, places like, well, now defunct Godiva, they used to sell chocolate truffles. Everyone knows where a chocolate truffle is. The big problem with most people's knowledge of chocolate truffles is most confectioners would put the truffle mix inside of a perfectly round chocolate shell. So there is consistency and uniformity, and I appreciate that. But a chocolate truffle is intended to be imperfect. So usually they're rolled by hand, and you're not going to get absolutely perfect by hand. They're going to have a little bit of deformity. Truffles, black truffles, are not perfectly round. They can be golf ball or ping pong ball size. I've seen them large. I've seen them as like racquetball and squash ball size. And like, wow, this is a thing. Summer truffles are good. Perigord truffles are better. And the price will reflect that. You can buy whole truffles online. Urbani might be the most reliable source. Not the cheapest, but the most reliable. They have a reputation to maintain as a premier truffle vendor, and I would trust them. Amazon has truffles on their website, and I would be very cautious about ordering truffles from Amazon. Not that, take from that what you will. Truffles are an acquired taste. One Christmas, my employer took the staff to a restaurant for dinner. Everyone came. The first course was truffle risotto. Now, the dishwashers tasted it, and it wasn't for them. As the busboy cleared the table, there was like 8 or 9 of us, and came around, he carried those plates of nearly uneaten white truffle risotto, which I happily and eagerly removed from him, scraped the contents onto my plate, and ate it. There is no way in God's green earth I'm going to let that go to the dish pit. I don't care who ate it. I'm finishing it. Now, one last story about truffles, which almost always has nothing whatsoever to do with truffles. Truffle oil isn't truffle oil. It's olive oil, and almost never is it truffle oil. There are rare occasions, but I think those are so rare as to be statistically zero. Even with the wee bits of something in the bottom, and we'll be generous and say it's a bit of truffle. Truffle oil is almost always olive oil with a concoction from the perfumery to make that aroma. Stop using it. Okay, that's the didactic, and that ends the vegetable portion of the vegetable chapter. Kind of funny, huh? Starches remain. Of particular note are gnocchi, and I'll probably explain. I can think of real quickly 3, but I'm pretty sure I'm missing one. So I think there's at least 4 different kinds of ways to make gnocchi. He also adds polenta, which is interesting for a French cookbook, and noodles, which just delights me endlessly. That's the Midwestern part of me being made happy with the word noodles. He means pasta, of course. I just like to say the word noodles because it's a funny story for me back as a kid. But other than that, those are the 3 main things so far. But I'm probably going to talk about something else because, you know, I'm me. All right, folks, that's going to do it. I'll add the link to the risotto episode on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/294. I'll also add a link to a blog post about Carolina rice for some quick basic information about what it is. As the garden starts to overproduce, I'm thinking zucchini here, the bounty is lovely, and repetition can get burdensome. Perhaps there are some ideas in these recent veg episodes to invigorate dinner time with new approaches to some of those veggies. Now, something Escoffier didn't mention, which probably he might do, maybe not add to this book, is a zucchini fritter. It's really simple to do. It's easily, basically, it's, now depending on how you mix, it's either pancake or muffin mix, not mix, batter, no sugar added to this, with some grated salted squeezed zucchini added to that, and then you do it in a cast iron pan. And what I say, in sufficient amount of fat. How much fat? Just enough. That's pretty good. Then a little bit of sour cream on top, and that's kind of a fun thing to do with zucchini. That's not the same rolled round pieces of zucchini. Oh, goody. So something else to try. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon.
Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.